This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Professor Richard Epstein is here commenting on the Biden administration's executive order, concerned about unfairness in the marketplace and bigness in the marketplace. Anti-competitive pricing would be an aspect of bigness. The professor guides me to Supreme Court cases that illustrate, one, a large firm taking over a smaller firm is not anti-competitive and is not unfairness. We established that from the 1960s in a Supreme Court case. Now we turn to, from the 1980s, the Burger Court, Matsushita versus Zenith Ratio Corporation. This is about the assumption by Zenith and others that the Japanese companies, Matsushita in particular, were anti-competitive, underpricing, dumping, or in some fashion defeating by conspiracy American manufacturers of television. The first irony here to mention is that Matsushita and Zenith, to my knowledge, perhaps somewhere they make television sets, but for heaven's sakes, I watch Amazon Prime on an iPhone. So 35 years later, this is an arcane discussion, but it isn't, because it turns on the presumption that there's a conspiracy, or that largeness can lead to a conspiracy, a blending together of competitors. The Supreme Court decided that was not true. It was a 5-4 decision. Mr. Berger, the Chief Justice, voting in the majority to survive petitioner's motion for a summary judgment. I read from the decision passed down in 1986. Respondents must establish that there is a genuine issue of material fact as to whether petitioners entered into an illegal conspiracy that caused respondents to suffer a cognizable injury. Richard, the decision has a lot of irony in it, but the chief fact is that you need to establish the conspiracy has actually damaged you with pricing, and they were unable to do that. There was the Zenith group was unable to do that in 1986. They're no longer in business, Richard, because they were speaking to the past. Is that an analogy we can speak to today with this concern of big tech, big Silicon Valley domination?
Well, look, it's a slightly different situation. The argument there was that there's something known as predatory pricing. And a predator is somebody who eats his prey. And large companies were said to be predators, and the little companies were said to be the prey. What happened in this particular case is this was another illustration of Japan Inc. being very strong in the 1980s at a time when everybody thought that they would take over the world. And as you recall, virtually all of their initiatives failed because they tried to undercut the market in the hope that they would be able to, quote unquote, recoup what happens after everybody else exited the situation. And much of the work done at the University of Chicago in the early 1960s, all the way through the 1980s, said that predatory pricing doesn't make any sense. There was a very nice article written in 1981 by my former colleague, Frank Easterbrook, who now sits with great distinction on the Seventh Circuit, who's ended with saying, forget about everything associated with predatory pricing. And the argument that they made would be twofold. One is that in order to make this stuff work, you have to lower your price below the level that it costs you to drive the competitors out. But the moment you lower your price, the demand for your stuff is going to become so enormous that it's not a question of losing $10 on the 100 units you previously made. It's now losing 10 units on the 1,000 units that you have to make. And once you start doing this, your competitors aren't going to follow you down that primrose path. They're going to stay on the sidelines. They may even buy your products at below market price, which often happens. And it turns out that you'll never be able to recoup this thing afterwards. Now, who's doing the predation? There are two ways to do this. There could be a single predator, or there could be a group of predators. Oddly enough, the single predator is more dangerous in principle, because after all the other competitors are shattered, he can raise his prices to whatever he wants. But if, in fact, you've got a consolidation or a consortium of different firms who are engaged in this so-called predation, once the market's over, they have to cartelize the darn thing. Otherwise, they'll compete themselves back to the competitive level. If they cartelize it, that's an admitted antitrust violation. If they compete it back to the competitive level, it means that it's impossible for them to recoup. So in the Matsushita case, they had several storehouses of paper filled with all sorts of stuff. And what happened is when it finally got to the Supreme Court on the 5-4 situation, they looked at the theory. They didn't look at a single document that had been prepared, saying, this just can't possibly work. And so what they did is they developed a category of stuff called per se legality. Now, as you start moving forward, it turns out that industries are, if anything, more nimble than they were before. And it seems to me to be pretty clear to say that the risk of predation is no greater now than it was in earlier times. And so when you read people like Tim Wu, and they start talking about the Gilded Age, what they really are doing is making this horrible mistake of thinking that the industry concentrations and patterns that you have in 2011 look like those that you had in 1900. And it's also the case, by the way, that the record in 1900 is also much more complicated. Standard Oil was broken up in 1911, and there's a huge dispute. Well, what was it worth? Because if you actually figured out what was going on when they ran the thing, they were still a monopolist, but the prices went down very dramatically because it turns out that the technology that Standard Oil was able to put together was so good that they cut prices by, 80%, 90% over fairly short periods of time. And so you wonder just exactly how much good this did.
We have a minute, Richard, and that's what I wanted to focus on, the irony here. Matsushita and Zenith are gone with the wind. Just as the Rail Trust of 1900 and Standard Oil, gone with the wind. For heaven's sakes, oil could be gone with the wind. And
so what you have to do is...
Concern of the future does not look at the facts of the past.
What happens is, so long as markets are dynamic, current things are, snapshots are not very reliable. And in this particular market, you look at companies like MySpace, who are they? And then you start looking at Facebook. You look at AOL. There's a lot of transformation and a lot of generation. So if you see a huge amount of venture capital organizing around all sorts of ventures in spaces that have never been developed, you stop worrying about antitrust concentration because it turns out they're going to develop markets that have never existed before with technologies nobody ever had. And you'd rather have a single firm, at least for a short while, in a market rather than having no market at all. And so essentially you have to think of, in dynamic markets, short-term monopolists, pioneers, rather than the enemy of the public.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, if in 1985 I'd said I'm watching Amazon Prime on my iPhone, they would have looked at me. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.